Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to That's Politics, where I break down the political news for the intellectual and curious mind. I'm Mackenzie Atkinson, and today I'm going to break down the connection between education and democracy through the lens of DEI in my last installment of my DEI series. As you have noticed, this is a very long episode. It's over an hour, and most of it is my interview with one of my former professors, Vincent Russell. It's going to be a complex episode, so I recommend listening to this episode in one go, either on like a road trip on your way to your vacation destination, or while you're doing some summer cleaning. I'd even recommend going back and listening to this episode a second time to really digest what Vincent tells us about the role of education in our democracy. Let's recap what we talked about in the last DEI episode when we talked about academic freedom and DEI, because it has been a few weeks since we last talked about this. So one, academic freedom is the practice of teaching and researching issues in established fields without the interference from political figures, donors, or other entities. This practice has been around since the 1800s. Two, teaching and researching DEI has come under scrutiny due to the January 21st executive order. And three, being able to research and educate without the fear of being fired is an important aspect of academic freedom. Now that we are briefed on where we left off, let's get into my interview with Vincent. Thank you, Vincent, for coming in today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So how and why did you get into teaching?
Great question. I think I've kind of always been interested in teaching broadly. Briefly in undergrad, I thought I wanted to be a high school social sciences teacher or like history teacher. But in undergrad, I like waited as long as I possibly could to declare a major because I just didn't really know what I wanted to do. Like I just was kind of interested in a lot of different things. And so I kept putting it off. And I finally met with like my academic advisor, and I was like, you know, one of the oldest people still meeting with like a general academic advisor in the undergrad office. And, you know, and so I was like, well, like I was thinking about maybe I could be a high school social studies teacher. And she was like, okay, that's great. You know, but like, you needed to have like started that your freshman year, you know? And she was like, if you were to now like major in education, like you haven't taken any of the courses in it, and it was going to be like 6 years before I could graduate. And so I was like, well, I don't want to do that. Like, cause it was just going to take too long. Like it wasn't worth it for me. So ultimately ended up majoring in communication. And decided like, but still didn't really have like a clear kind of path. Like, what was I going to do? You know, I was just kind of in college, and I had started college because of some parental encouragement. And, you know, but I was at the time I was a musician, like I was just playing in my band, and like that was my passion, what I wanted to do. And so for me, like college and school was kind of like a side thing. Like I went to classes, but like that wasn't my job. That wasn't what I was there for. You know, so anyways, by the time that I was getting ready to graduate, though, my band had dissolved, you know, so I was in a big kind of transitional moment. And now I'm like, it's literally my last semester of undergrad. Graduation is imminent. And I don't really know what is next for me. And
which is like an average experience, I feel like.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I had not thought about, like, I wasn't thinking about jobs or career paths or anything because I, you know, just like just living, taking things day by day. So I ended up taking a course my final semester of undergrad called Reclaiming Democracy. And it just, it was one of those college courses that, I mean, I know it's cliche, but it changed my life. I mean, it was such a phenomenal experience. And It was a unique course. I did undergrad at UNC Greensboro, and it was a course that involved students from UNCG, Greensboro College, Elon University, NC&T State University, and Bennett College. And so five faculty plus a community instructor, like who was like an activist organizer in Greensboro. So we had six faculty teaching the course. It included students from all five of those campuses, and it was open to people from the community who could just take the course because they wanted to learn more about democracy and activism and all that. And, you know, so it was just this really special experience. Like, we took the class in downtown Greensboro was our classroom. And for folks that aren't familiar with North Carolina, I mean, like, the students from Elon University were commuting from Elon to come to Greensboro to take that class. You know, like, they're driving anywhere between 30 to 45 minutes, depending on traffic, you know, and we met once a week in the evenings. And so it was just this, like, it just felt so special. And the professors in that course were, you know, just so fantastic and really left an impact on me. And it reignited for me, like, a passion in civic engagement, social justice activism that had kind of fallen by the wayside. Like, in high school, I was, like, president of my student body. In middle school, I was, like, president of the middle school. So I'd been involved, like, student government in the past. But then once I was into college, like I said, kind of like music and my band was my kind of primary focus. And so I had kind of let a lot of other, like, my other interests had, you know, fallen by the wayside. And so this course, Reclaiming Democracy, just kind of reignited that passion in me. And I saw what an impact these professors could make on students, on their community, you know, and really make a difference. And so it was kind of like a light bulb for me that semester. I was like, I want to be a professor, you know, like, I want to have the opportunity to hopefully, share with students some of those same insights that those professors inspired me to pursue. And if I can, you know, make that difference in people's lives and in my surrounding community, then, you know, that's worth my time and energy and what few talents I have, you know, so I'll put it towards that. So that's my very long answer as to, like, why I started getting involved with teaching.
So what was the class about? Like, you said it was Reclaiming Democracy. What was the focus of it? Because I know you had, didn't you just come out with a book?
I did, yeah.
I bought it last night and I started reading it.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
So I'm looking at it. I'm like, okay, I've heard him talk about these things already. Mm-hmm. So this is a recap of the classes I've taken with you. But isn't it Redefining Democracy?
Yeah, my book just came out earlier this year. It's called Reimagining Democracy, partly inspired by that college course that I took all those years ago. I mean, more than 10 years ago now. And that the name of that college course was itself inspired by Dr. Cornel West and a book that he published called Democracy Matters, where he makes the argument in that book that we need to, that, you know, working people, everyday people need to reclaim democracy because it had been, you know, captured by the oligarchs, essentially the ruling class. And so so the idea of that course, Reclaiming Democracy, is to explore basically what it means to be a good citizen. What does it mean to live in democracy? At the time, the course has since evolved since then. But, you know, and so at the time we were talking about, like, you know, how can we engage in community change? How can we make a difference in our communities? And then given the focuses of the professors who taught the course, it also had a strong focus on education. So we spent a lot of the course talking about basically, for undergraduate students who weren't education majors, like, none, and, you know, it was basically...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Basically about like, how did we learn what we learned in school, you know? And so like, it's, you know, cause I had never really thought much, you know, you just go to class, you take classes, you do papers, you do whatever the teacher tells you to do, you know, and, or not, you know, and so I'd never really thought much about it. And so in that course, we were introduced to like different approaches to teaching, even though none of us were going to be, at least at the time, like, you know, I don't think many or any of us as students were education majors, but the idea was to get us to reflect back on how had we been taught in our lives from, you know, kindergarten through college. What was that learning experience like? What was emphasized? What were the skills, the capacities that were being taught? And for us to realize that those things, like that those were choices that educators, administrators, politicians had made that we as students, I mean, all of us as students, have oftentimes little say in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
I feel like I'm like, okay, you are going to learn what I have planned for you. And sometimes it just, you're getting told what to learn.
Yeah.
Which I feel like that was K through 12. College, I got a little bit more say in it, mm-hmm. but K through 12, definitely you have to go by the curriculum that's set by the state.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So Reclaiming Democracy was about kind of teaching us that those are essentially, those are political choices, you know, that those are choices that were made. And so what if education looked different? What if democracy and citizenship looked different? What would that be for you? And so in the course, we explored various you know, theoretical approaches to democracy and education, you know, looked at case studies. And a big focus of the course was on kind of the legacy, the importance of social movements for accomplishing social change. And for me, it was my first real introduction into kind of a grassroots approach and understanding of the role of everyday people in improving the world. You know, so much of like history and civics education that I had been taught was so much a top down, you know, the model of like great leaders, you know, mostly old white men.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Imagine.
You know, that these venerable, wiser than all of us, these great, great men, you know, were the ones that had steered history for ill and for good, you know. And Reclaiming Democracy was about like, well, really, it was, you know, working people, everyday people who have really been, you know, kind of shifted the focus, say that they've been the engine of change and focus. So that was the focus of Reclaiming Democracy. And I think, and that has continued to inspire my focus in teaching research. And so my book, Reimagining Democracy, is a study of two grassroots efforts to pursue social change. It's a study of a process called participatory budgeting, which is my research expertise. And, you know, and so in that book, I call it Reimagining Democracy because I really try to center residents in Denver, Colorado. And for folks who are unfamiliar, participatory budgeting is the idea of giving residents control of how to spend a portion of typically a city's budget. So instead of just voting for city council members or a mayor and then they make the budget, you know, the idea here is that with participatory budgeting, you know, what if we just let the people decide how to spend their tax dollars?
Very much like a direct democracy model.
Yes, exactly. And so my focus was, okay, so when that's happening, what are people talking about? You know, I'm a communication professor, right? So how are people communicating with each other? What are they saying to each other? What are the, you know, the scholarly term we use is, what are the discursive moves that they are making to try and realize social change? And of course, as a communication person, for me, you cannot separate talk from action. You know, you often hear, right, like, oh, we need less talk, we need more action. But you don't get to action without talk, and talk itself is important action, right? And so what I write about in the book, Reimagining Democracy, is that as these participants deliberated about where they want to spend their money for community improvement projects, they also began to talk about, well, like, what kind of community do we want to live in? As a community, a neighborhood, it was, the process happened in a neighborhood and then on a college campus. So, like, as a neighborhood or as a college, how do we want to interact with each other? How do we want to build spaces, you know, to treat each other with respect, equity, fairness? And what would that look like? And so in the process of simply deciding what looks like relatively simple community improvement projects, like, nothing that got proposed and voted on in PB was all that revolutionary or groundbreaking in these processes. Like, they voted for, like, a portable movie theater so that they could hold community movie nights, you know. Students on the college campus voted for more microwaves in the school cafeteria because...
I can agree with that. I can never find a microwave to, like, heat up my food that I bring from home.
Right,
so.
Right. Yeah, it's a need, you know. But what motivates that decision is this idea of, like, well, we have a lot of commuter students, like, they can't, you know, and a lot of commuter students are working, like, they're working class students. They often work part-time off campus anyways. And so how can we create a campus space that's more hospitable and inclusive for them? Right. And so that's where kind of the microwaves thing comes from. But when you just see the ballot, it's like, all right, microwaves, like, whatever. But in the process of reaching that decision, the people who participated in the process began to think about, like, well, who is in our community? How do we want to treat each other? And then along the way, they start to realize, like, wow, like, we could make these decisions for ourselves, like, in the spirit of direct democracy, you know, like, there could be things like participatory budgeting implemented in many places, in many ways, where we just empower everyday people to make decisions about how we want to live together. And so that's why I titled the book Reimagining Democracy, because, and I opened the book talking about, like, democracy is in crisis. You know, it's less popular than ever. You know, there's all kinds of problems in society, polycrises of democracy. So what do we do about it? And I think that what the people who participated in PB, they began to reach some of those answers for themselves. And so that's why I say that they're reimagining democracy, because through the process of deliberating, they are reimagining how they want to live with each other and how we want to govern ourselves in potentially new and more just ways.
Yeah, because so many people have gotten used to this, oh, we elect a representative, they go up and they make those decisions. Mm-hmm. Reimagining it is bringing the power back to the people to make those decisions.
Right.
Fantastic idea. I can get behind that. I would like to have more microwaves on campus.
Well, and, you know, not to get on too much of a tangent, but, you know, PB has been used in schools, participatory budgeting, PB for short, has been used in schools across the United States. Colleges do it. The school district, like a public school district in Phoenix, Arizona, they have K-12 students decide how to spend their, like, the education, Department of Education budget for that precinct. Now, it's always usually a fraction of the, it's no one's controlling all of it. But, you know, the model, the original model for participatory budgeting, it started in Porto Alegre, Brazil. And at its peak there, residents were deciding how to spend 80% of their municipal budget in Porto Alegre. You know, so that's all the people of the city. And for folks that aren't familiar, Porto Alegre is a huge city. I mean, it's got a population of more than 1 million people. And, you know, that was everyday people in that city deciding how to spend 80% of their own tax dollars. So all that's to say is, like, it has been done, it is being done, and it can be done.
Yes, I like put the money.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Where I want the money to mm-hmm. be, or we want the money to be. Mm-hmm. So let me get into the types of classes that you teach.
Yeah.
So you teach intercultural communication here along with like the basic intro comms. I took your intercultural and your research methods class.
I'm sorry.
That challenged me, which I haven't been challenged in a minute when in college, but that class grinded my gears and got everything going. But you also taught discourse, culture, and identity at the University of Colorado Boulder. Mm-hmm. And did you also teach the Reclaiming Democracy class at UNC?
Yeah. So my relationship with that Reclaiming Democracy course evolved over several years. So and I'm still in contact with those faculty. I consider them friends. And so we joke sometimes, but because I think I'm the only person. I liked that course so much, I just kept coming back to it. So I took it as an Reclaiming Democracy. I took it as an undergrad student. I then myself became a community organizer and got involved in an effort to implement participatory budgeting in Greensboro. And so as part of that, I became a community partner for the course. Reclaiming Democracy is a service learning course, which for folks that may be unfamiliar, basically means that it requires students to engage in community projects with community partners. And that can look like working with nonprofits. It can look like working with activist groups. And service learning itself is a huge thing that takes a lot of different forms. But anyways, I became, because of my work with participatory budgeting, because I was leading that organization in Greensboro, I became a community partner for the class. So students in that course ended up working with me on that campaign to get PB adopted. Then when I entered graduate school, I did work as a teaching assistant for Reclaiming Democracy. And so I taught some courses, did some grading, helped with, you know, prep, all that good stuff. So
the behind the scenes of teaching.
Yes. Yeah. So that was my involvement with that course. But all in all, yes, I teach intercultural communication, research methods, some public speaking courses. And then, like you said, discourse, culture, and identity, which I do have a version of that at WCU, which I'm I changed the name of it. It's called Discourse, Culture, and Ideology, for reasons that we could maybe get into later. But those are the kinds of courses that I tend to teach.
So why do you like to, I know you already kind of talked about like your teaching philosophy and the idea that you want to teach these people how to be active citizens in a roundabout way. But these specific classes, why do you think those are important to teach mm-hmm. in today's day and age?
Yeah. Great question. I like to teach those particular courses because I think that they teach students the skills and theories that I think are necessary for life in the 21st century. If we are going to live in a diverse, pluralistic society, at least in the United States, and I hope that we'll continue to live in a diverse plural, but if that's the case, then people in general, and my job is to teach young adults mostly, but young people need to know how to communicate across difference. Because that is the fact of the world is that society in the United States demographically continues to become increasingly diverse. We are a multiracial, multi-ethnic, liberal democracy for now.
Yes, we'll see where we're at.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes. But at least that is for many kind of what the purpose of living in the United States is about. And so, additionally, the world right now, and especially the United States, is pretty messed up. We've got all kinds of crises happening, crises of democracy, an epidemic of loneliness, healthcare, record levels of economic and wealth inequality, police violence, climate change, right? It's just so much. And if we believe in democracy and we believe in a diverse democracy, then students need to know how to fix these problems. They need to have the skills to be able to address these pressing issues that all of us are living through because, I know it's cliche, but the future belongs to them, right? As in young people, yeah. but the present does too, climate change is here, right? And we need all hands on deck to begin to address some of these, critical essential challenges. And I think that's what democracy is all about. And so we need young people to get engaged, to help fix you know, so many of these in the literature, like the academic literature, we call them wicked problems. You know, that these are like the really tough, hard things to address in society. There are not going to be magic technical fixes for things like climate change, for racial injustice, you know, for the prison industrial complex, for the U.S. empire. Like, no one's going to be able to come up with an app to suddenly solve like all the challenges and any and injustices of imperialism. Like, that's not going to happen. That happens through people working together to figure out what are the causes and what are the potential solutions, because those are social challenges. And that's what communication is about. You know, and so in my courses, I try and teach students the skills of living in a diverse, pluralistic democracy, whether that's skills of negotiation, skills of facilitation, skills of communicating across difference, interpersonal communication, like learning how we can manage our relationships, public speaking, like how to advocate and make your case, you know, take a stand. And did I say negotiating already? You know, but the idea here is that, you know, these are the skills that we need for democracy. And so I think that helping students understand who they are, like thinking about identity, like who they are and how they relate to other people and to society, and then how they can exercise their agency in making an impact on other people and society. You know, that's kind of my sort of, I don't know, like mission, I suppose, as an educator, is to get students recognizing those aspects and equipping them with the skills to, you know, to take action where they see fit.
Yeah, because I know in your intercultural, we focused a lot about different aspects of society and the issues that will come up throughout them. I remember talking about, like, we did a section on race. I remember talking about, like, trying to think back, because it's been a year since I've taken your course.
Yeah.
But we talked about like the different perspectives and different things that we wouldn't necessarily consider from other people. And I remember talking about like immigration and how each of us took a role as an immigrant to try and put ourselves in those positions and to understand where some of these people are going through, because we have to like interview them. That's like the exercise you had us do in that class. So how do you go about including diversity, equity, and inclusion? Because that's like the overarching thing, because if you don't talk about the differences with people, intercultural is the whole idea of DEI. So how do you approach that in a classroom and in an academic setting?
Yeah, I think it's probably good to like note for listeners. So I'm a white guy, you know, and to that extent, like I think in kind of the field of intercultural communication, I may be somewhat like less common, you know, but because of my identity and my background and where I come from, the way that I kind of approach courses like intercultural communication, discourse, culture, and ideology, you know, I do my best to try and expose students to varying worldviews, in a way to get us to understand, you know, because I don't have the life experience myself necessarily to talk.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got, from plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
About, you know, like racial oppression or gender oppression, or, you know, you know, sexuality challenges, right? Like, because I have not lived through those, right? But there are plenty and plenty, fortunately, you know, there's lots and lots of resources that I try and leverage. And so I do my best to remain, you know, curious, open-minded, tapped into, you know, whether it's like, you know, the news or documentaries or podcasts or things like that, and do my best to kind of try and cast a wide net to find things that may be of interest to students to help illustrate and bring in, you know, these stories, examples, perspectives from, you know, frankly, around the world, to try and get students thinking outside of themselves. And what I emphasize in my courses is, you know, that as we come to understand other people better, we come to understand ourselves better too. You know, and I think that's something that I try and drive home, is that as we come to explore our differences, you know, I hope a lot of the time we also realize so much of what we have in common, and that although these differences in identity or ideology are certainly significant, and they are real and material, you know, housing discrimination, right? Like, you know, the anti-trans bans, right? Like, all of that is real stuff. And at the same time, I think it's important for students to realize that those differences matter, and like they kind of don't matter, because we do still have a lot in common. And that if I can come to see myself in my, you know, trans classmate, in my Black classmate, in my female classmate, right? That if I can see myself in them, then I start to see my identity tied up with them. And so that anything that is injurious to them becomes injurious to me, because we are more connected than we are separate. But we need to have that exposure to differing worldviews and perspectives so that we can come to understand other people and then better come to understand ourselves. And of course, you know, obviously all of this comes from, you know, my positionality as a, you know, relatively, you know, middle class, cisgendered, straight white guy, you know, and so I hope that I try and do my best to model for students that, like, that these aspects of difference and identity don't need to be feared. Certainly it can be uncomfortable to talk about these issues, right? But if we are committed to working together, to loving one another, to getting to know one another, then we start to realize that we can create a world that is fairer and more just and kinder to all people. And that for me is really kind of, I hope, one of the takeaways that my students get in the class.
So an overarching theme here is the connection between democracy and education in its entirety. So how do you perceive the connection between education and democracy? Both, I don't know if you want to like comment on like K-12 and the establishment of the idea of education versus like higher education, where we're diversifying.
Yeah, I'll probably focus more on higher ed, just because because working in K-12 public education is so different, you know, and I just want to recognize, like, I'm just not qualified to speak as much on that. I know some of the history about, obviously, like the history of just education in general in the United States, but most of my experience comes from working in higher ed, and I guess I think first I want to start by saying that, like, I hope that, like, almost everyone likes democracy, I think, is a good starting point, right? Like, are you pro-democracy or anti-democracy? At least in the United States, I suspect that most people be like, yeah, democracy's good. Like, we're going to thumbs up that one. I'm again, that may be changing. But, you know, I think almost everyone likes democracy. So as a society, if we can mostly agree that democracy is important, that it's a good thing, then we have to think about how we prepare young people to be citizens. I think that's like the next logical step. Like, if we're just abstracting and thinking about, like, as a society, as a shared group with a shared destiny, like, if democracy is important, then how do we emphasize it? How do we teach people to participate in democracy? How do we prepare them for that? Because, you know, as my own experience, I think, illustrates, like, you don't just magically acquire knowledge about all those skills that I've talked about, you know, how to do research, how to communicate across difference, how to speak publicly. Like, that doesn't just happen. And so I think it's a reasonable step then, and this is historically what has been the case, is we then say, well, like, we should teach people to be citizens. in schools, whether that is K through 12 and in higher ed. And when I talk about citizenship, like in general, I want to be clear, like I'm not talking about necessarily legal status. Like that's a different thing for, mm-hmm. for me. And for, I think a lot of us scholars, when we are thinking about citizens, like citizenship is a set of values and practices that anyone can adopt and enact. So if we want to be, if we want people to be good citizens, then how do we prepare them for that? What do young people need to learn to perform good citizenship? And that is where education comes in, and especially higher ed. And like an example of is the, of this is in the words of Thomas Jefferson, he has this quote where he says, an educated citizenry is a vital requisite for our survival as a free people. You know, so even Thomas Jefferson, who was himself super racist, a slave owner, I mean, not in the, I don't know, we could, you can have your debates about him, but he doesn't have a lot, like there's a lot of people that don't like him. And even at the time he said this quote, he certainly did not think, all people should be educated. Right. But as the great civil rights lawyer Lewis Pitts once told me, the purpose, our purpose as citizens is to make sure that the commitments of the Constitution are applied to all, that they may not have been initially designed and intended for everyone in the United States, but we are here to make sure that the Constitution lives up to those promises. So all that being said is that colleges and universities have a dual pedagogical mission. By pedagogical, I mean a teaching mission. So first, we have a responsibility to develop students' critical thinking skills, and simultaneously, we need to prepare students to be informed, engaged citizens. And in 2022, there was a court case related to actually things about academic freedom and things like that. But at the time, federal judge Kevin Newsom ruled, he argued, like this was in his ruling, in his write-up, federal judge Kevin Newsom said that the chief mission of higher ed is, quote, to equip students to examine arguments critically, and perhaps even more importantly, his words, not mine. So even more importantly, to prepare young citizens to participate in the civic and political life of our democratic republic, end quote. So citizenship preparation has been central to the mission of higher ed for more than a century. Countless schools around the United States include in their mission statement some kind of language around preparing their students to be global citizens or engage community members or responsible citizens. You know, pick your term, but the idea here is that, you know, many schools and universities are doing this. So higher ed is a training ground for citizens. In that capacity, we give space for young people, although also like, you know, older adults, like anybody can enroll in college. But yes, you know, so we give space for students to practice activism. Through that, they learn how to advocate for positions, how to make alliances and compromises, how to negotiate, all those skills that I talked about earlier. And so in my classes, that's what I try to teach my students. I try to teach them the skills of citizenship, give them opportunities to practice those skills. That may look like facilitating dialogues and deliberations about contentious topics. It might involve analyzing the root causes of injustices. It might involve power mapping. It might involve studying past social movements to identify what we can learn from them. And it can involve partnering with community groups to help those groups achieve their social justice goals. But the idea here is that, you know, when our students leave our classrooms, they're going to go out and they are going to be involved in their communities. And what I often remind my students is like jobs change, you know, jobs come and go. But what will remain the same your whole life is that you will be a community member. No matter where you move, where you go, people are going to look to you to be a responsible member of your community. And, you know, and so we need to help students figure out how they want to navigate that responsibility.
Yeah, I remember that was being like that was a big thing in your intercultural class, is that we participated and worked closely with other like community organizations. Like I worked with the Center for CECL. That's what it is in my head.
The Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning.
Yeah, I worked with them on civil dialogues where we brought people together and had them like just talk about these really controversial topics. I remember we talked about, does my vote matter? As the polling booths were open across the the hallway from us.
Yeah.
So, and we also had people working with Indivisible, which is the voter registration. Yeah. I'm realizing I didn't take your class a year ago. It was last semester.
Last semester, yeah. It was only a few months since that class ended.
It's been decades in my mind.
Yeah.
Even from my perspective, being told, hey, you have to engage with your community, because that's always been something that I've been like, okay, yeah, we need to engage in our community. But you told us as an assignment, go out. Now that has made me feel more comfortable to do that after I graduate. Even today, I'm working closely with the Silva Herald and the idea that newspapers and the news is the backbone of these communities. Because if you don't know what's going on,
right,
there is no community.
Yeah.
So I want to say you did a good job.
Oh, thanks. Good. I'm glad.
There was things taken out of that class that have now been implemented later on.
Oh, good. Well, before we move on, I am okay. If you'll indulge me.
Okay.
I mean, I did want to just give space for kind of the counter argument, right? In the spirit of dialogue and deliberation, kind of hearing all sides, right? So, I think that they're, kind of the other side of thing. I think people sometimes can be, critical of this idea of schools being set to prepare students for citizenship. And this can show up in ways of you need to go to school to get a job, right? You got to work, you got to make a living, and schools need to be preparing people to work, or schools need to be preparing people for practical things. A common thing, at least online, is oh my gosh, how come I never learned how to do my taxes in high school?
Yeah. Or individual finances, but that's a college class.
Yeah.
We have those.
Yeah. And I would point out, learning to do your taxes is citizenship. That's a requirement of living in, frankly, kind of any government, much less a democracy. But I hear that and I understand that. And in my experience, I've had, first generation students, right? Who have come from working class or working poor backgrounds, and they see college as this is a path of social mobility for them, this is potentially their chance to get ahead, and for many of them, and then help their families, right? I'm going to graduate, I'm going to get a good job, and then I'm going to support my mom, or my grandma, or, my siblings, right? Because it's on me, to help, get us ahead. And education, I think, broadly gets advertised as this engine of social mobility, and kinds of things. And when we say that, we are talking about educating for the workforce. I mean, I think that's kind of what it comes down to.
I know when I was in high school, we definitely were this isn't set up to teach us how to be good people. This is teaching us how to work in a factory.
Right.
The rows of people sitting in classrooms, there's not very much engagement, not a lot of community. It's you're sitting here, you're going to learn what I tell you to learn, and you're going to write it down on notes, and you're ever going to regurgitate it to me on a test. And that was most people's K-12 experience, at least from mine. Of course, I'm Gen Z, so I might be different from yours. I had some little group clusters in classrooms, but at the end of the day, we still all did the same thing.
Yeah.
But to get into a college classroom setting where we're interacting with each other, we're debating, we have the ability to connect with people versus just being in a classroom with someone, learning stuff and then leaving.
Yeah.
So I think that speaks to the intent, the execution of education in K-12, at least in my experience.
No, yeah, I would agree with you. I think that a lot of, from what I have heard, I don't have children myself, but I am teaching a lot of Gen Z folks. But my friends in education do kind of argue that things have gotten, they think, better, a bit more democratic in a lot of public schools. But my experience was similar to yours in terms of it was quite rote. You've got the bells that are meant to signal this is from the Industrial Revolution era, but the shifting whistle in a the shift whistle in a factory that blows, that's really what those classroom bells are about. It's training you to
you hear the bell and it's like, all right, now it's time to, you know,
move on.
Yeah. Third shift's coming in, you know, kind of thing. Right. And then, yeah, like you are just a passive receptacle of knowledge, and that's meant to train you to be an obedient worker, frankly. And so critiques of higher education say that, like, well, we haven't done a good enough job preparing students to be workers for the 21st century or for the future, those kinds of things. But I would argue first that the skills of citizenship that I'm talking about are practical. And I say this in class a lot, that, you know, the skills of, like, negotiating, advocacy, public speaking, these interpersonal skills, you know, communicating across difference, those also can be applied in many workplaces. But if we are thinking beyond that, I think, you know, obviously I think we have a responsibility to think about it in terms of, like, community engagement and things like that. But this idea that schools need to prepare, like, colleges, especially colleges and universities need to prepare folks for jobs, is part of, like, this broader neoliberal attack on higher education, because this narrative implies that the education system is permanently deficient because it always fails to produce enough of the right kind of skilled workers. But the question is, like, who comes up with that metric? Who decides whether schools are training workers well enough? And of course, the answer is, you know, forgive me for sounding, you know, like a radical or anything, but the answer is the capitalists. I mean, it's the people at the top, right? They set up this metric. They then decide, oh, well, you're not training enough workers in the right skills, and so we need to defund higher ed, or we need to take over higher ed, or, you know, we need to change the curriculum to help, you know, set up America to succeed in this hyper-competitive, globalized society, et cetera, et cetera.
Or dismantle the Department of Education.
Right. You know, so it is these people in power that make up their own metric, then arbitrarily subject higher education to this made-up metric, say that we are permanently failing to meet a metric that many of us in higher ed, like, think is arbitrary and capricious, and that just further, and they will never, because it's in their interest to say that we aren't doing a good enough job, they will never say that we do a good enough job preparing students to work, because that would then imply that, because then they're able to give up that power, right? Like, we can never satisfy that demand enough, because the capitalist class ultimately just wants to maintain its control over the higher education curriculum. So, I think it's important for people to remember that higher ed, colleges and universities, like, they're not responsible for the lack of good paying jobs. You know, higher education is not responsible for people not being able to afford their necessities, for the offshoring of jobs, for increased immigration, like, and the list goes on and on. And because higher education, because college and universities are not the cause of these problems, no amount of education or education reform will fix those problems. You know, for example, I'm part of the millennial generation, and the big headline, you know, back in the 2010s was that millennials are the most educated generation in the history of the United States. More of my generation went to college, got degrees than ever. Now, if the narrative of social mobility, of preparing students for the changing workforce, like, if that was true in even a small way, right, then we would see things like economic inequality go down. You know, we would see wages go up, you know, because millennials are the largest generation in the history of the United States so far, and we're the most educated so far. Now, we'll see if Gen Z can beat us. You know, I hope
so. I'm scared. Alpha has already started. I'm scared.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, but we know, if you just look at the facts, like, that is not the case. Despite millennials being the most educated generation in the history of the United States, economic inequality at an all-time high. Millennials themselves face, frankly, you know, dire financial futures, in terms of, and partly because of student loans, because of the economy. I mean, lots of reasons for that. But millennials and Gen Z are looking at a decreased quality of life compared to prior generations. And that is despite being some of the most educated in the history of the United States, right? And so I think what this shows us is that higher education is not about training good workers. Like that simply going to college is not going to fix all of these problems that America is facing. And there is no amount of defunding higher ed, taking over higher ed, banning DEI, none of that, like I said, is going to raise wages, is going to, you know, bring back well-paying jobs, is going to help unions, is going to achieve health care. Like, and so this neoliberal takeover or attempted neoliberal takeover of higher education expects us to produce ever more disciplined, ever more productive, and ever more obedient laborers for the capitalist class, because they don't want us educating people to be good citizens, critical thinkers, engaged in their communities, making a difference. Because if that happens, then those students can then begin to change the status quo, a status quo that has so far benefited the ruling class, you know, the oligarchs, the top 1%, whatever you want to call them, you know, but it has benefited, that system currently benefits them, and they want to keep that system for as long as they can to maintain those benefits. And if we teach people to be critical thinkers, to be engaged, to interact with democracy and actually implement the rule of the people, then that can upset the status quo. And so that's why you see all of these attacks on higher education and things like that, because it is about maintaining control. It is about maintaining the current system that happens to benefit a very, very small portion of our population.
Yeah. And you see that college students are some of the most active groups of political activists, like talking all the way back to the Vietnam War.
Right.
The college students were the ones protesting and making a fuss about it. And most recently with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the genocide in Gaza, we saw what happened at Columbia University.
Yeah.
Students were camping, protesting, saying cut ties with Israel, and they were being attacked. They were being imprisoned. And it's the idea that if you give them education, if you educate them, they take back their power and they question your authority,
mm-hmm.
which is inspiring, because I also have an issue with authority, but now give me an education and it's going to be a whole different thing.
Right. Yeah. You're their worst nightmare.
I like to say I'm the next generation of political reporters, where we question literally everything and we don't respect them for it.
Good. Yeah. They don't deserve our respect. Look at the state of the world.
Anyways. So you did talk a little bit about like the perceived attacks on DEI and mm-hmm. education. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the perceived attacks?
Yeah, sure. When we are having conversations about DEI, I always think about like, well, first, like it's always just good to say, like, what does DEI stand for?
Which is the question of today. Like, what even is DEI? How far are you going to go?
Mm-hmm.
That's part one of this episode.
Okay.
Where I just talk Great. About what it is.
Oh, good.
What it might be.
Yeah.
It's a slippery slope, well, but it's yeah. the idea of like, we don't know what it is.
Well, and that's what I was thinking, is that like, I think that the vagueness is entirely part of the point, like the amorphous nature of it. Right. Because, it sounds like you probably already covered this in part one, but like, yeah, like what even counts as DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, does that include like cultural festivals? Like if a school celebrates Lunar New Year, is that like, you know, because that's a significant cultural festival for folks, like, is that now suddenly DEI? Is that like woke mind virus? We need to get rid of it. You know, like,
woke mind virus.
I think about like student affinity clubs, you know, like a club for even just like a club for veterans. You know, like, is that suddenly, I mean, that's about inclusion of a particular population, like a student club of veterans. Is that DEI needs to get banned? I don't know. You know, I don't think so. You know, is like the Black Student Union.
Yeah.
You know, is the, you know, the Latin American Student Organization, like, I mean, and the list goes on and on. Right. Like, and then, of course, it comes to, well, what about like curriculum? Like, is this DEI, you know, is African-American studies suddenly DEI, right? Like all of these. And so I think that the amorphous nature of it is part of it. But back to what we kind of talked about, I think that in general, if we just, you know, if you just take the words at face value, diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, those are essential if we want to live in a pluralistic democracy, like we were just talking about. You know, because we need to teach students to work through and across difference, to recognize that we have more in common than we do apart. And that, you know, my particular kind of canard here is that, you know, working in intercultural alliances is, I would argue, essential for promoting social change. You know, if you look at history, like, you know, the labor movement was, you know, a huge, you know, cross-class, multiracial, multigender movement. You know, the civil rights movement, you know, was also, I mean, it was certainly led by African Americans, but I mean, you know, white folks participated in that, like Asian Americans, Latinos. I mean, it was a multiracial movement of people in the 1960s civil rights movement, right? I mean, and the list goes on and on. And so, you know, the more that we can build alliances with diverse people, the more that we can learn to practice empathy and understand these historic inequities that cause both material reality today and people's feelings about each other, you know, then that's good, I think, for democracy. And so when it comes to kind of like the attacks on DEI in higher education, you know, I do think that first and foremost, they are attacks on academic freedom. And, you know, we don't have, that's a whole like other
can of worms.
Yeah. Can of worms. Yeah. An episode, the idea of academic freedom, but essentially academic freedom is a type of free speech. And so if you are a fan of free speech, you, I hope, are a fan of academic freedom. And academic freedom is a foundational principle of U.S. higher education. It is the idea that made, I would argue, it is the idea that made our colleges and universities in the United States like the envy of the world, was the ability for academics to teach and research according to their disciplinary expertise, to have free reins to pursue the truth. That's what academic freedom is about, is that it gives academics the ability to pursue truth, even when that truth may be inconvenient, may be uncomfortable, may be upsetting for people. You know, like the classic example, or, you know, is wow, this is going to be embarrassing. Who is the guy that came up with like the heliocentric model of the universe? The sun is at the center of the galaxy.
Oh, the flat Earth. I think of it as the flat Earth theory.
Yeah. Okay. So somebody can fact check us here, but like, you know, but yeah, this idea that, like, you know, that. That to argue that the world was round all those years ago, right? Or that the sun is at the center of the galaxy, you know, the solar system, and not the Earth. Like, these were considered, you know, heretical ideas at the time. Like, you know, people were thrown in jail for them. And that's what happens when we get rid of academic freedom. You know, and obviously I know that was like hundreds of years ago, but the idea here is that in the United States, prior to academic freedom being, you know, well instituted as a norm, you know, academics were being punished. They're being fired for exploring things like evolution, you know, for exploring, you know, like workers' rights and organizations, for critiquing their administrators, for critiquing politicians, for not pursuing, you know, what we know to be truthful and effective policies, right? And so the idea here is that academic freedom, as annoying as I know academics can be, like I am one of them, I know that we can be a pain in the butt, you can ignore us. But the idea here is that we have to, that professors need to be protected to pursue the truth. And that's what academic freedom is all about. And so these attacks on DEI are about limiting academic and students. Students also have academic freedom because y'all are researchers in training, you know, and these attacks on DEI are about, first, I think, limiting faculty's academic freedom to further constrain what is able to be taught in classrooms because of those reasons we talked about, like desiring control over what gets taught. And, you know, and how people graduate and like what it means to get a college degree and those kinds of things, you know, but. And so this is how it can undermine free speech, like the attacks on DEI themselves are attacks on free speech, whether it's for students or faculty members. And it's important to remember that universities want to educate a diverse population. Now, part of that is like structural and because of changing funding models. So, and this is part of the neoliberal regime, but, you know, in the starting around the 1980s, as states begin to divest from higher education, they stop funding higher education so much. Universities then need to try to increase their quote unquote customer pool, their students, because now instead of the federal government or the state government just giving universities, here's just enough money to function, to work, you know, to do what you need to do. Instead, in the 1980s, we say like, well, the funding needs to follow the students, you know, so that funding should be based off of like student demand. And so these schools, as they lose kind of, you know, the broad scaled funding that supported their missions, now they have to compete for varying students. And so many schools realize, well, we're going to have to recruit more students than ever, right? And we can't keep teaching all these white kids, because historically, like, you know, that was what was happening. And so they begin to, some of this started to happen like with the student movements in the 60s. I would argue that the defunding of higher ed in the 80s is a response to the activism that students were doing in the 1960s and 70s to create a more inclusive curriculum, to create a more welcoming campus. Anyways, so part of why universities in general want to retain diverse students is because they need the money.
I get it's a business, yep, at the end of the day.
Yeah. But second, it is part of our mission to educate all, you know, all people, right? Like the United States Postal Service has to deliver mail to everyone in the United States. We've decided that's a public good and is essential for life and existence. And so regardless of whether they turn a profit or not, the United States Postal Service has to deliver mail everywhere to everyone in the United States. Similarly to, I mean, it's not as like intense and serious, but higher education, we have a commitment to teaching everybody, you know, and so because of that, universities, colleges want to retain a diverse population. You know, students of color, LGBTQ students, you know, students with disabilities. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so DEI is about creating an inclusive environment, creating spaces for those diverse students who historically have been left out of colleges and universities, being able to adapt to life on campus, being able to retain those students so that they can then get that, you know, that education. And so that's part of kind of, I think, the free speech angle. The second part about like the DEI attacks on colleges and universities, I do think it's also a dog whistle, frankly, that, you know, in reality, this is a cover for certain parties to pursue what I would describe as a white supremacist agenda that undermines civil rights.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, about how they are taking these out so you can't question the fact that the United States sometimes, actually pretty often, was in the wrong and was pretty bad. So that's, I think that's also kind of what you're getting at here, too, as well.
Yeah, yeah. And because of the way that these DEI bans are being enforced, you know, it becomes about eliminating and attacking, you know, anybody who doesn't fit the mold. And that can look like people of color. It can look like women, LGBTQ folks, you know, disabled folks and other marginalized populations. And so and that's because it is like there are anti-discrimination laws on the books, right? It is illegal to fire someone because of their race or gender, again, for now.
Yeah, we'll see.
You know, but if we say that they're a DEI hire,
it like discredits all of their hard work.
Yes. And it can mask that gender and racial based discrimination, because I'm not firing you because you're a woman. I'm firing you because of DEI, you know?
Yeah.
And that becomes then about your work, quote, I'm doing air quotes, like that becomes about your work, the quality of your work. And so suddenly it becomes this convenient excuse to purge anyone who doesn't fit this white supremacist capitalist education agenda, you know, because it's about getting white folks and especially white men to look at other, you know, classmates, their coworkers, and begin to think like, I'm not sure you belong here, you know, because you're a DEI hire or you're a DEI enrollment, you know, and that you didn't come here based on merit. Right. Like, and so because of that, we can kick you out. And so that's this kind of workaround for essentially legalizing gender and race-based discrimination, because I think, you know, the Trump administration doesn't want, like, I think it would be unpopular to attack outright civil rights laws. Like, if they go out and they say, like, oh, like, because again, like, we were joking about, like, people like democracy. I think in general, if I was like, I think civil rights, most people are like, well, those sound good, you know?
Yeah, like, you would think. And they have been using, like, the Civil Rights Act to, like, substantiate their claims that this is racist, DEI is racist, mm-hmm. because it's now excluding white people. And the Civil Rights Act says all races, which includes white people. And they included it in both the Dear Colleague letter that they sent out at the beginning of February.
Right.
And in both of the executive orders that had something to do with DEI. And I'm like, you are taking something that is good, mm-hmm. and you're manipulating it and you're framing it in a way that benefits your bad agenda.
Yeah.
In my perspective, at least. Of course, I'm biased. I'm a human. I have my own perspectives on it. I'm a woman. But, like, I've even seen some representatives discredit Kamala Harris saying that she was a DEI hire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no, she worked her way to where she was at. And you're going to just discredit her because she's a woman.
Right.
And she's a black woman at that.
Yeah.
It's infuriating.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No. And so, you know, I think that what this does is, you know, again, like, as a dog whistle, it gets those of us who are not in power to, like, you know, the working class, working people, you know, to look at each other, and it promotes. And so, like, you know, they, people on the right are attacking DEI because they're saying, oh, this promotes, like divisiveness, and it gets people hating each other. But it is the attacks on DEI themselves that are doing that, you mm-hmm. know, because it's trying to recruit white folks, men, you know, to look at people who are different from them and say, like, oh, you don't belong here. Yeah, you're a DEI hire. You know, your work doesn't matter. And so that is what's dividing. And all of that is a distraction to keep us everyday people divided, and so that we don't pay as much attention to what the oligarchs are doing, you know, to what Elon Musk is doing, to what Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, like, all the people in power, right? Like, and so they don't want, you know, and because the thing is that all of us benefit from cultural celebrations. Like, all people benefit from learning about Black history. And importantly, despite the portrayals of certain, like, DEI initiatives, like, you know, we talked about, like, the student affinity clubs, like, anyone can join these clubs. Like, there are white folks who joined the Black Student Union. You know, there's white folks that joined the Latin American Student Organization, like, because it's about sharing our backgrounds. It's about sharing our perspectives and understandings. You know, obviously, like, white people major in African American studies. There are men who study feminism, right? Like, these are not the ways that they actually show up on campus is that they are open and available to all people, and that benefits all of us. And so if the idea of, like, oh, if we can ban DEI, you know, what they don't want happening, like you were saying, is they don't want people learning that inequality is rooted in anything other than personal choices, you know, because they can say, you know, oh, like, because as we ban DEI, as we push out and purge people of color, women, trans folks, gay folks, you know, all of our, you know, multicolored, multiracial, beautiful brothers and sisters, as we purge all those people out and we have these and we start to create all white institutions, you know, all male institutions again, which I think is kind of the goal here. You know, then we look at that and say, like, because of DEI, we say, like, oh, well, people got here because they worked hard enough, right? Like, because they were just better, right? Because we've banned DEI now. Like, we're mm-hmm. colorblind, you know, we're not looking at any of that. But of course it's the opposite, you know, and so when we ban DEI, the idea here is that we can then blame people of color or women or people with disabilities, that we blame them for not being good enough, quote unquote, you know, to be in our spaces, that they didn't meet the high standards, you know, the quality.
Merits to be where you're at. They're masking it as going back to a quote unquote meritocracy, mm-hmm. even though technically speaking, everything's going to be based off of merits. And it's just acknowledging the fact that there are underlying, like, cues that people don't know. They have their own biases. They have their own assumptions over what name sounds white or black. Mm-hmm. And it's just acknowledging the fact that those are there, they exist, and we need to move away from it. And it's acknowledging our own biases that I think is the biggest driving force of DEI, especially when you talk about in the workforce or in academic admissions, which I feel like anytime DEI, affirmative action quotas, anytime those ended up in court, it was all over college admissions.
Right.
So you talk SFFA, v. Harvard and UNC.
Right.
What was it? University of California v. Bake. I can't pronounce that name.
They typically pronounce it. I mean, it's not like I knew the person, but I think they typically pronounce it as Bakke.
Bakke. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. I was like, I just know how to spell it screen. But like, it's always over college admissions, which I feel like also kind of touches on the idea that education is the driving force of all of this.
Right.
And that is why I'm here. Why you're here to talk about all of this.
Yeah. Because, like I said, they don't want, I think, you know, the people in power, and that's what I mean by they, you know, people in power just don't want us learning about these historic inequalities and the legacies of this systemic discrimination and bias, and realizing our power, that if we can begin to reject these, you know, false ideologies that separate us and begin to realize that we do have more in common, then we can start to exercise our collective agency to change, like I said earlier, that we can then start to change the status quo and maybe kick some of those people out of their positions of power and put everyday people in their place.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. We are at like an hour and 8 minutes. And I know you said you only had an hour to talk, and I was like, oh no, I'm going over. Oh, well. But again, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about the role of democracy and education and how they're all intertwined.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. Would happy to be back if it's ever useful, helpful, things like that. So
much has happened since I started this journey looking into DEI at the beginning of February. Right before part 3 dropped, some news was brought to my attention. A conservative journalist group, there are air quotes around that, called Accuracy in Media, or AIM, has swept through North Carolina. There are some reports of these quote-unquote reporters posing as concerned students to get into meetings with administrators. Once they get into these meetings, they are asking leading questions about DEI policy and these specific administrators of their opinions on DEI. The kicker? These meetings are being secretly recorded and then later being posted on YouTube, and they are garnering tens of thousands of views. As a result of this, administrators are being fired. Some of the most notable administrators fired are Megan Pugh, the former UNC Asheville Dean of Students, and from my alma mater, Karen Price, who served as the Director of Institutional Assessment at WCU. There are many other videos on AIM's YouTube page, which include many different universities. Their most recent video as of this recording was at UNC Wilmington. This gotcha style of journalism is unethical and goes against the SPJ Code of Ethics. Academics are now fearing for their livelihood. The federal government is sinking its teeth into higher education and has turned people against learning. If there's one thing that you take away from this series, I want you to know that learning is uncomfortable. I recently had a conversation with my in-laws about everything that is going on with higher education. We came to an agreement that if you are not willing to have uncomfortable conversations, then you shouldn't be the one in the position where these conversations are needed. Educators at all levels are willing to have uncomfortable conversations because they care about the students they teach. They have hopes that the world will get better. And I hope the world will get better. But we have to be able to talk about uncomfortable things, to be able to confront our biases, to notice and acknowledge the foundations of our systems to be better. Thank you for coming on this journey with me. I hope you have learned a lot through this series of episodes. To view source material for this episode, visit the website at thatspoliticspodcast.com and make sure to follow us on Facebook. I also introduced a new feature on the website called Blog Posts. There you will find updates about previous episodes and current event updates, along with my thought breakdown like you see here on the episodes, just in written format. Stay tuned for a new episode of That's Politics, where I'll be talking about autocracy versus democracy. I'm Mackenzie Atkinson, and I'll see you next time.